Welcome to episode 120 of the Forward for 50 podcast, where we interview people over 50 pursuing new direction for their lives. It's an opportunity for men and women to tell their stories their way and in their own words. I'm Greg Gerber, the founder of Forward from 50 and your host for today's show. Today, I'm privileged to speak with Tom Smith, a man whose life took an unexpected and remarkable turn after he entered his seventh decade. A lifelong skeptic, Tom spent his career rising through the ranks of retail management and leadership training, never giving much thought to spiritual matters. That's until a series of surprising experiences led him to a profound faith journey at the age of 60. Now 72, Tom is on a mission to help others discover that it's never too late to find meaning, purpose, and even start a relationship with Jesus. In this episode, Tom shares how his journey unfolded from moving back to Arizona for reasons he didn't fully understand, to developing an unlikely friendship with his future pastor, to having deep daily commutes with Jesus that completely reshaped his outlook. He also discusses how a simple prompting to help a homeless man named Jacob became a life-affirming sign that there really are no coincidences. Now the author of a new book, From Skeptic to Salvation, Tom is determined to share his story and encourage others to embrace the possibility of transformation no matter what their age. To tell us more about what gives his life meaning and purpose in his 70s, please welcome Tom Smith to the show. Thanks for joining me today, Tom. I really appreciate your time. Now, I understand you no longer believe in coincidences. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. My life used to be that everything just was happenstance, coincidence, and that there was really no grand scheme to things, why things happened. And fairly recently, I was proven wrong about that, and that there is no such thing as coincidences. Everything is part of a master scheme of things that's driven by God and Jesus. And I was fortunate to be able to personally experience that.
I can imagine. What did you do for a living before you retired?
We have shared something in common. We both got degrees in police science. And I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to be a chief of police. And so I went to NAU and got my degree in police administration and went through, this was over a year's worth of testing with the Department of Public Safety. And so I wanted to be with the state police. And I was in the final 60 out of 2,000 applicants, and I got bounced out because of a back x-ray, they said. But it was during the affirmative action years, and they said off the record, the reason that we had to eliminate you from the upcoming academy is because you're white and your last name's Smith. If you had a Spanish surname or you were female, then we could meet our government or federal funding requirements. That's what I wanted to be. And that was a blessing that I didn't go down that path. But I ended up getting into retail because a best friend of mine got me into selling waterbeds. And I took to it. I never thought I'd ever be a salesman because I had a stigma. I had a negative connotation about what sales was all about. But I ended up staying with that company for 17 years. And rose up through the ranks and ended up being a director responsible for about 25% of the country's showrooms, retail stores. And as we transformed from waterbeds, I got into a company that sold Sleep Number beds. And I was basically a sales trainer and leadership development, a trainer for many years. So I converted from being a introverted, shy guy to being a sales trainer. So that's what I did most of my years. Though a test that I took in junior high said I'd be most likely suited to be a forest ranger.
So did I. That's exactly. That is too funny. They must have had a rush on needing forest rangers at that time.
Yeah, that's where they put people that don't feel comfortable around other people.
That's probably right. Or don't play well with other people.
That's right, exactly. Yeah.
Where are you from?
I consider home Tucson, but I grew up in a military family, so we moved every 3 years. We were like migrant workers, but my father was in the Air Force, and so we rotated every 3 years, which that was a tough one as a kid because you're always making friends and leaving friends and then making friends and leaving friends. But I found out that even that was a blessing because in my adult life, I relocated from one market to another. So it had prepared me for the ability to transition and make new friends, establish yourself in a new environment more effectively.
I would imagine you have friends all over the world now.
I don't.
Oh, okay.
Because most of my friends are here in the U.S. because I was a kid back then, elementary school, junior high. Once I got into high school, I became a bit more stable. And as far as where I live, so I spent many years in Tucson, and then in my career, established friends in the different markets who are lifelong friends today. But yeah, we lived in Germany for 3 years, and there's a couple people that are still, I stay loosely connected to, where we share that similar background.
One of the things about your story is that you came to faith rather late in life, and really late in life.
Very late. And it's kind of like one of those things, not as close as the criminal hanging next to Jesus on the cross, and where he said, wow, that was a close one.
Yes.
Waiting a little too late. But yes, I was 60 when I came to Jesus, or when he found me as a good shepherd looking for his lost sheep. I was definitely lost. And so I'm now 72. So this whole experience has been 12 years, and that's relatively new, considered newbie in my spiritual walk.
What prompted this decision to start exploring your curiosity about faith?
It wasn't a decision. That's the remarkable thing. If it had been up to me, I'd still be wandering around out there aimlessly without spiritual foundation. And that's the essence of the book, is that just these spiritual encounters, these promptings to do things or take action that I normally wouldn't have done, led us from living in California, coming back to Arizona for some, just a feeling. We left our kids in California and just uncharacteristically came out to Arizona, like the Beverly Hillbillies, but in reverse, of California to Arizona, and wondering, why are we doing this? And I sold my business in California just spontaneously. And my wife, Karen's an RN. She was able to take a job in Arizona, but home was Arizona. So we were coming back home. So we had that feeling that for that reason, but I had a stronger purpose, and that's to reunite family. And I had not been connected to my family because of working out in the hinterlands and rarely being able to get home for the holidays, because at retail, you are all hands on deck during the holidays. And so my family needed me after many years of not being available to them. So that was the driving force. But like I say, when I moved back to Arizona, I ended up moving next door to Brad and Elfie. And Brad, turns out, was going to be my future pastor. I didn't know it at the time, but I moved into what I refer to as a Copper Hills Church sandwich. I had Brad and Elfie on one side, and then two friends of ours that went to Copper Hills for an extended period of time, Tom and Pat, were on the other side of me. So Jesus had put me in an environment that I had no option but feel his presence.
I can imagine. What do you think was behind your initial skepticism?
I guess some people might consider me somewhat of a quirky kind of guy. My humor is a little off center, and I didn't consider myself skeptical. I thought that's what everybody felt, but I think I was jaded by the persona of the Jimmy and Tammy Faye Baker crowd and the wealth pastors who are preaching, pontificating something, and they're wearing $5,000 suits and have multiple mansions and driving Rolls Royce. I was just somewhat jaded about that. And I think a lot of people are. They get their perception of religion about who they see and who they're exposed to. And so I was skeptical there. But I just was always nervous around church people. I don't know why that was, but in the book, in the introduction, I said that I suffered from some social anxiety, and I believe that Satan used that to his advantage to keep me polarized from a relationship with Jesus. And it wasn't until I met Brad, and Brad's messages each Sunday is not about religion, but it's about a relationship with Jesus. And I was going to Copper Hills Church for some time, and I was doing what I thought was everything was right, because I think a lot of Christians do that. They said, okay, this is what we need to do. We're going to go to church every Sunday. We're going to serve at church. We're going to attend small group meetings and do all of that. And I was doing that. I said, okay, I got all the bases covered. And till one Sunday, one of his messages resonated with me, and that's about having a relationship with Jesus. That concept never even occurred to me. Well, plus, how do you have a relationship with somebody you can't see, or an entity that you can't hear or see? So it was like having an imaginary friend. I said, I never had an imaginary friend when I was a kid, but a lot of kids did. And anyway, he told a story about going out to the park and having a conversation with Jesus, and right out loud. And people were walking by and they can hear him, and they're thinking he's some kind of psycho sitting at a park bench and just eating lunch and talking to having a conversation with the voices in his head. But he said that it was very rewarding for him. And so at the end of that talk, he suggested that everybody in attendance that day, that week, that they commit to having lunch with Jesus. So just go out, have lunch, have a conversation. I worked every day in a small retail environment, and I couldn't do that. So one thing led to another. So I had an epiphany. Why not have my 45-minute commute to work be a commute with Jesus? And that's how my conversations with him and my relationship with him began. And so 5 days a week, 45 minutes on my drive to work. As soon as I got in the car, I'd start chatting with them. And it was amazing, because then I realized, isn't that how relationships begin anyway? Even with amongst us, we get together, we have a conversation, we get to know about each other, and we tell each other about what's going on in our minds. And so that's how the initial relationship began.
Okay. That's a very interesting story, but you're right. You can't have that relationship without having that contact. And the problem with a lot of Christians and early Christians is that they think the relationship involves always talking to Jesus, but never pausing long enough to hear his response back. How do you do that?
This is interesting. I didn't catch myself. He made me aware that I was doing all the talking, blah, 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 for 45 minutes. I thought only women, I shouldn't say that. That's not socially correct. But anyway, men typically don't have that much to say where you can talk endlessly for 45 minutes. And my wife and her friends, they can chat about anything for hours. So I was on my way to work, and I was having that conversation, and I hear this voice in my head. Be quiet. And it just struck me, and I had this prompting, you know what? I'm doing all the talking. And what does that feel like when you're with somebody and they're doing all the talking? You don't feel important. You can't get in a word in edgewise, and at some point you just don't want to be with that person. So that was an epiphany, or a prompting that he gave me, that this sometimes having a relationship is just being quiet and letting those messages come through from him. And so I learned a ton there. But yes, it's to hear his voice, which I've heard multiple times, and some in a more corrective fashion, was just really unsettling at first, but reassuring on a different level. Yeah, that I will always remember that. I made reference to that in the book also. That was the first time that I heard his voice. Basically told me to shut up and let him have a little bit.
Yes, that is great. A lot of people think that the voice of Jesus is going to be condemning and always telling you that you're doing things wrong. But I've not found that to be the case. Most times, Jesus is more corrective in his nature. It's like the voice inside of you is saying, you really screwed up now. There's no hope for you. You blew it. It's not going to be recovered, etc. And Jesus says, I think you could have taken a different approach on this. Let's talk about